Welcome back to another episode of Conversations with Nova Reed. Oh boy, these weeks for you are either going really slowly or really fast. For me, it's gone really fast. So last week I had the pleasure of hosting a week-long programme for black and brown women on how to navigate everyday racism and aid their own healing. And it was really deep work, but also quite powerful. So I've been recalibrating over the past few days and coming back to you with a rather glorious episode today, an interview with Joanne Bradford, founder of Mother Heart. And we're talking about everything in this, from sobriety to therapy to tone policing to our own anti-racism journey. And yeah, it is fire. I just want to give a caveat before we get into it. Joanne is quite early on in her anti-racism journey. So there are elements within this conversation where we are interrogating her inherent racism. So if you are black or brown, just proceed with caution. It's nothing big, but there are some things there that may or may not trigger. And what you may notice is Joanne and I are interrogating on this. It's very conversational. I add a lot of lightness to my work, and there's also some firmness there. So you get to see, you get to observe both of us in action, really, just getting curious. And to me, that's what this work is all about. Getting curious about why we think or behave a certain way and unpacking that. And so we have a really interesting back and forth about tone policing. I didn't give the definition as we're talking, so let me give it to you now. So tone policing is it's a form of an anti-debate tactic, and it's not something that happens consciously. It is for some, but not always. And it generally is very effective in the way that it moves the focus from the conversation, from the matter at hand, onto the person's tone. And so black women get tone policed a lot. We're too angry, we're too aggressive, we're too divisive. And so all of these common racist tropes that are thrown about the way in which we deliver some information. And so there's an element where she's getting curious about if she is tone policing and if she is finding my work more palatable because it is delivered in a certain way, or whether or not it's just personal preference. So we go back and forth on that. And I think it's a really, really important dialogue. And I want you to just observe without judgment and see what comes up for you. And I really hope that you enjoy it as much as I did talking with Joanne and putting this episode together. So yeah, I'm going to go dive in. Enjoy. I have another wonderful human being with me today. Welcome, Joanne Bradford, founder of Mother Heart, counsellor and coach. Can't wait to dive in and converse with you today. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you for having me, Nova.
So let's dive in. Who are you?
Who am I today? Who am I? So I guess the things that spring to mind are non-work related, actually. I am a cat mother.
I'm laughing because I've just got kittens.
Oh, yay. So you too are a cat mother.
Oh, boy, yes.
Oh, love them. Love them. I'm a cat mother. I am particularly at the moment very obsessed with my cat because I've got way too much time on my hands. That's really the defining aspect of my life at the moment. I am sober. I am married. I'm a wife of, I guess, maybe 4 or 5 years now. I am by nature, I would say, a nurturer, someone Lovely. Who likes to help, fix sometimes, which is not ideal, but yeah, someone who wants to move towards solutions and making things fair and better, I think.
Yeah, really lovely. Thank you. And I mean, actually our paths crossed, Joanne and I's paths crossed. I just suddenly had this memory. I was just going to say, I met Joanne. She's another one of my anti-racism students. And we met at my, I hosted an in-person supper club in September last year. But actually we met before because Joanne and her husband's wedding was featured on my wedding blog called New Bride many, many, many years ago when I was working in the wedding industry. And we've come back full circle unexpectedly, I think.
So we had contact all the way back then.
It's quite profound. Yeah. So we've both been on our own journeys. Yeah. So I'm just gonna dive right in and just see what comes up for you with your automatic response. Yeah. So when did you realize you were white?
When did I realize I was white? I think the earliest memory that I have about being aware, and it's actually really the only time I've ever felt in the minority, was I was on a tram in San Francisco, and I was probably, I want to say 15, maybe somewhere around that age. And I looked up and I realized that everyone in the carriage was Asian, everyone. Mm-hmm. And I was like it really shook me. I'd just never been in that situation before where I felt like the outsider. So I feel like that was probably the first time that I became aware of my skin color.
And that feeling for you was an immediate feeling of not being safe.
Yeah. Yeah. I felt like that I'm not part of this, the people that look this way, and I'm here and I feel on my own in this carriage. Mm. Yeah.
Mm. So tell me, where did you grow up and what was that like?
So I grew up in rural Cheshire. So very white, very white. I think, yeah, we had like in my school year, I think there was one Asian female and that was it. Everyone else was white. I from a young age, I sort of went out clubbing and all of that. And so I was integrating more with people from different backgrounds and people of different skin colors at that point, but that wouldn't have been till I guess 15, 16. But my early years, everything I did extracurricular and certainly in school, everyone was white.
And that wasn't that you didn't find that unusual at that time?
No, not at all.
It just was.
So I suppose, you know, as a kid, I was aware that I've always been very aware of my very pale skin. Mm. So not so much about being white, but being whiter than all of my friends who would point at my skin going, oh my gosh, you're really white. You know, you're really pale. You don't go brown at all, which is the case. I just never remember really having a realization that I was a white person.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
Which makes sense now that, you know, we're going on this journey together. So when was the moment when... And maybe it wasn't a moment, it might have been a collective, but when did you realise that you wanted to do anti-racism work?
I think it was directly off the back of Layla Sard's, the white supremacy, Me and White Supremacy Instagram challenge. And I actually can't remember why or how I came across her work, but it was around the time that she launched that. It must have been the result of me following someone who was talking about her. And I was like, oh, this looks interesting. I like to be challenged. Mm. And this was an area that I really had not ever unpacked. Mm. So I think it was purely out of curiosity. I didn't think I needed it. I have to be very honest about that.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I was like, I mean, we all say it, don't we? You hear lots of white people who've started doing the work going, oh, I was one of the good ones. But I felt like... I literally was like, yeah, this doesn't apply to me because, and actually this is important, I guess, part of my story. How old was I? So I've had many boyfriends in my life. I've had many boyfriends. But I had, as a teenager, I went out with a mixed race guy from Manchester. Mm-hmm. And so that was from 15 to 16. And then my second to longest relationship to date, bar my husband, who I've now been with for 6 years, my other longest relationship who I lived with and stuff like that was a black guy from Handsworth in Birmingham. And we were together for a long time. And so when this work came up with Layla, my automatic assumption was like, you know, I've been in relationships with black people. I have black female friends. This is not going to be something, I'm not going to unearth much here, but I'll do it because I like to be challenged and I'm sure I'll learn something.
That's very interesting.
Yeah.
I love that you, even though you didn't think you needed to do it, you still had a curiosity to do it.
Yeah.
Because there are many that they don't. They think they don't need to do it, so they won't even bother.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm glad that wasn't me.
I'm glad that that wasn't you too. Yeah. So what was that like, just going on that initial journey with Layla's 30-day white supremacy challenge? Did anything shock you? Did you unearth things that triggered any surprise, guilt, shame? I don't know. Just what was that like for
yes,
you?
Yes, 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 and yes. So, I mean, firstly, I think the nature of it, like some people literally to this day are like, I can't believe you wrote your answers on her Instagram feed from your mm-hmm. business page. Like, why mm-hmm. would you do that? And so that was the thing that I had to get over initially is like, do I want to put this, if I'm going to do it, I'm going to do it honestly.
And wonderful.
Do I want to commit these words when I probably am going to get it wrong and possibly cause offense? And the stuff that I'm excavating here isn't meant to be pretty. So yeah. I was like, oh, like I don't want to upset people. I don't want to alienate people. And actually, initially, you probably know, Layla was asking us to post the prompts on our own page.
Yes.
And then that changed because it was too triggering, understandably, yeah. for people of colour. So then it was very much going to her space and posting it. And I decided I would carry on doing that because that was what was required. But I have to be honest, there was a big part of me that thought, what are people who aren't doing this work going to think?
Yeah.
Because people who aren't doing this self-examination might see me as racist for writing yeah. these things down. And that's horrible. And I don't want people who don't understand to think that of me. So that was like a self-interest concern. And then, yeah, there was some really interesting things that came up. There was stuff from my past relationship with the long-term boyfriend I mentioned that I had never thought about when we were together. Things where he actively said, that's really offensive. Please don't say that to me. And I didn't listen to him. Like, I completely cast aside his feelings over certain situations that came up. And so it was really, it was uncomfortable to uncover that stuff and to share some of those conversations and the context in which that happened. You know, so many years later.
Were they sort of phrases that you would say or behaviours? Anything that you want to share to give context?
Yeah.
If it's a phrase?
It wasn't a phrase particularly, but we had, I still don't exactly know where I stand on this, but I do feel, basically it's because I didn't validate his feelings is the issue that I have with this specific situation. Perhaps you'll say, it's not so bad. I don't know. His sister had got a tattoo on her back and it was quite big. And mm-hmm. she had very, very dark skin. And I said to my ex-boyfriend, I don't think tattoos look nice on black skin.
Mm-hmm.
And she'd just had one. Loads of his friends who were black had tattoos. Mm. And he said, that's really rude. And, you know, and I said, no, it's not. It's just an opinion. Da, da, da.
Yeah.
You know, and I feel like we're entitled to our opinions. But also, if you're hurting someone's feelings and they're telling you, yeah. And there was no space for that. I was just like, oh, you're being really sensitive. You know, I wouldn't say that to her, but I can say it to you. But it was hurtful to him on yes. his sister's behalf.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so going through that process, it sort of uncovered that. And what was, I'm going to change this slightly. So what was it that led you to go beyond that 30-day challenge, I guess, to seek out some of the work that I offer and yeah. you know, do even more work in person with other people? And yeah, what was it that what made you want to do more?
I think realizing it was a very humbling experience, that process, and there were lots of elements that I did excavate which I found unattractive.
Yeah.
And I'm very aware that I'm at the beginning of this journey. Like, I'm under no illusions that I've been cured of, you know, the mindset.
White supremacy.
Yeah, so I feel like it activated within me a desire to very much continue. And also, and I know I've said this to you directly, to seek out people who live in the country that I live in, because as amazing as Layla's work is, and there are other people as well, kind of worldwide that I tune into the voices of, I felt like I wish I could find someone who is based in the UK, because it is very easy to think that this problem exists over there.
Yes.
You know, like in the Middle East or, in America, it's really bad. But actually, what's going on in the UK? Well, we're not really talking about it, so it's probably fine. And so it was a real gift to find you, because I was like, oh my goodness, someone who is really, in, you know, proximity-wise, very close, talking and identifying behaviours and mentalities that are happening here in London, in the outskirts and beyond, you know?
Yeah. So when you started leaning in, I remember we had a conversation about when you first started to express or to invite people in your circle on your Instagram into exploring anti-racism work. I remember you saying the first response or your first few posts were like tumbleweed.
Yeah.
How did that make you feel? And what did you do to not get discouraged by that?
It's actually been a beautiful lesson, the tumbleweed thing, because all of my favourite things to post about, the things that I actually do genuinely care about, don't get likes. So anti-racism work, God, sobriety. No one wants to like those. Like, you know, I mean, it's a generalisation. Some people, it's really their thing. But actually, they're not the posts that get the engagement. And I realise they're all my favourite things. And so am I creating a grid so that I can get affirmed around meaningless quotes that I don't really believe in? That's an option. But no, this was just another example of, is this place on Instagram, my little hub, is it going to be a place where I post and I actually don't care? Like, I really can't afford to care about whether people like it or not. I know that they're seeing it.
Yeah.
And that's the most important thing. So it has been a gift, those situations, like I said, anti-racism and other topics, the things that are most dear to my heart right now at this point in my life, I'm like, good, don't like it. It's fine.
Yeah.
I know you read it anyway.
Lovely. Yeah. So just not attaching the outcome and continuing to share it anyway, because it's important. Yeah.
Yes.
I love that. So tell me more about, what have you found most challenging about anti-racism work, your own journey?
Okay. I'm going to bring up, you might remember this from your in-person masterclass. I remember it because I asked a question and I felt the response from you and from other people left me feeling exposed. And I still don't have a kind of firm resolution on this area, but it is the thing that I struggle with. So I'm going to share it.
Great.
And maybe we'll talk about it today. So I understand what you and others talk about in terms of, is it please toning or tone policing?
Tone policing.
Tone policing.
Yeah.
And I'm very aware that I can't just tune into happy, happy, polite people all the time. But I do struggle. And this again is, it's in this area, but also I know in the sobriety field, I just have to mute people who are too aggressive and actually unkind with haters and people who are coming onto the grid and maybe saying things that are provocative or they don't get it. I struggle with witnessing interactions that feel very aggressive and that don't feel to me that they're driving towards a solution at all.
So let me, so I know where we're going.
Yeah.
So we spoke about this on my anti-racism workshop. So let's unpick, what does aggression mean to you? What's your definition of that state? How are people behaving when they're in a state of aggression?
So something for me, and I have to caveat this with, sometimes I think it's justified and I think it's done well, but there have been instances where I've seen a white person's words reshared publicly and encouragement to kind of go over to that person's page or, you know, to kind of further bash and shame them. And for me, I just think, I don't know if that's going to help anyone. It's fueling a lot of anger. And that person is just going to close up like a clam. I can't imagine that they'll ever engage with anyone on this topic again.
So I see that as shaming. So I think, so I come from a therapeutic background and I work based on the notion and the understanding that shaming other human beings is not the grounds for change. And I think shaming and aggression are two different things. They might intersect, but I believe that they are two different things, I think. So do you see aggression and anger as the same, or are they separate?
Yeah. That's a good question. Do I see aggression and anger as the same? No, I think I see them as separate. I think you can have righteous anger and it can mm-hmm. be communicated in a way that really reaches the other person. Aggression, to me, my current understanding of it, I guess, is to inflict harm. It's not a productive force. It's something that you're doing to lash out and negatively affect the other person.
Okay. So, yeah. So I guess continue with where you're going.
Yeah.
Continue.
Yeah. So it was that really, that the thing that I find most challenging is sometimes in this space, anti-racism space, and I said, as in other spaces as well, I find it difficult to stay with those voices. And the big question for me is, if I unfollow this person, am I tone pleasing? Am I saying your tone is not acceptable to me? So I'm taking you out because I need to live this happy little life. And I really don't know the answer. But what I do know is I value my peace of mind. And when I get riled up by certain ways and behaviors that I see playing out online, you know what it's like, it can be.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think just carry on sitting with it. I think it is very nuanced because as I encourage in my teaching around, it is very important, particularly for Black or brown people, to protect their energy. Mm-hmm. It's very important for us to look after ourselves when we're doing this work because it triggers shame, it triggers guilt, it triggers anxiety. So we need to be looking after ourselves and being mindful of that. But then there is the other layer of tone policing. So it's just getting curious. Am I, you know, is this showing up in other circumstances or is this only with Black women? Mm. Am I struggling with this behavior in other people, in men, in white men, in other characteristics? Yeah. Or if not, let me notice if it's only with Black women. Mm. If it's only with Black women, then I would start interrogating around that.
Yeah, that's a really
I think that's the difference. Anger, human condition, we have a right to express it. Some people find being around anger, myself included, I'm getting better with it now because I'm doing my own work on myself. I'm doing work on myself. I've had therapy. I engage in healing retreats all of the time. So anger is a trigger for me. In other people, witnessing other people's anger is a trigger for me because I personally don't feel safe because of my own personal experiences of being on the receiving end of anger. So I find it really difficult, and it was recognizing, wow, I'm frightened right now. I'm going into a state of flight and fright, but I've actually got nothing to be afraid of. Mm-hmm. So I recognize that, right, that's a trigger for me. So I need to lean into that and do some work on that. Mm-hmm. So that's why I'm like, where are these behaviors only triggering you or only coming up in certain types of people, or is it with everyone? I think there is a nuanced difference mm-hmm. between, you know, engaging with and sitting with discomfort and learning. But if what you're saying is that you just shut down completely, mm-hmm. Then I would encourage you to lean in with that. But if it's that I'm not shutting down, but I'm finding it hard to engage for these reasons.
I hope it's that. But yeah. I will sit with it because I don't know. But I hear you and I don't know the answer.
That's what I mean. Yeah. It could be either. So that's why I'm like, recognize when it's triggering you. Is it a certain type of, is it just Black women? Then you need to lean in the way in. I do also want to caveat that shaming doesn't work.
Yeah.
And I talk in the same way with when we get into politics, when you've got liberals who are all for equality and they hate and they cannot stand social injustice. And then I see them dehumanizing people who have voted for Tories.
Yeah.
And for me, it's that element of dehumanization and shaming that is dangerous because it is those ingredients that have been part of every single mass genocide in history. So I'm not saying that it's easy when somebody has done something to you that feels horrible when you want to lash out. I'm not saying that is easy, but if we're then dehumanizing them and shaming them and treating them in a way which we don't want to be treated ourselves, there is no difference. There's no difference. We feel morally that we might be better, but it's not. And that to me is what I'm talking about. We can hold people accountable for their racism or for their behavior without shaming. Yeah. So that's my stance, and I will always stick with that because, you know, the research, but it doesn't work. You know, we all know what it feels like to be shamed. If I call you in for your behavior and you feel shame as a byproduct, that's different to me consciously and intentionally wanting to shame you.
Yeah, understood. Which is honestly why I find your work so powerful, is because there are so many teaching points. But I think I've said this to you before, my heart feels like receptive and open. You know, it's not, I don't feel, there are things that are difficult, that can be difficult to swallow, but I don't feel there's no attention, intention of attack when you're speaking about certain things. And for me, my heart is able to kind of receive and to digest and to sit with things much more easily in that space, because I guess it feels safer.
So what has been some of the, so I've asked you about some of the challenges, what has been some of the triumphs or some of the joys or aha moments from engaging in this work?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm just thinking about like real life connections. I guess on a kind of, it's really weird. I don't know if this is something that you've experienced with your white friends, but I have got several people of colour in my life who I consider fairly good friends, and yet we never really spoke about this stuff, which is worrying. And I now I'm like, okay, I think you must speak with your other black female friends about this, but not with me. So I think it's been nice to be able to just be able to have conversations. And again, I've had to be really mindful of like not going and trying to like pick people's brains, being like, oh, I'm really struggling with this thing. And it's like, can you shed light on it for me? So I'm not, that's not the kind of intention with my engagement, but just because obviously those people in my life follow me on Instagram, they can see that I've been engaging in the work. And so just opening up a space where previously we haven't acknowledged that we are different colours and that we do have a different experience of life, and will continue to, I'm sure, unfortunately, for a while. And so that's been nice, just that it's opened up a new dimension of the friendships that I do have with people who are not the same colour as me.
So you think that those relationships have deepened as a result?
I hope so, because I wasn't even aware of what was not being discussed previously.
Yeah.
So I think they must have done. I feel that they have. I hope that my friends feel that too. Yeah. Yeah. So you think that's been a benefit, a perk.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Right. I have so many questions in my little kitty. can you... Okay. I'm going to start with this and then I'm going to lead into the next question. So... Joanne and I had a moment in, so before all this kicked off with CV19, we probably went to the last large mass event before everything got shut down, really, which was Women of the World Festival at Southbank. And Layla Sard was delivering a talk as part of her book tour. So the challenge that we just discussed is now a book. If you want to buy it, find your local online bookstore. And I was there with a few other anti-racism students. There were about six of us there. There were three or four of us sitting together and then a few down by the front. And I just picked a row. And I didn't notice that Joanne was sitting in that row. I just happened to be sit next to her. I was gossiping away with my anti-racism students. And then we were halfway through the talk and I was sort of looking at Joanne's profile thinking, she looks really familiar. And there was a moment in the talk where Jude Kelly, who is founder of Women of the World Festival, asked Layla a question. And I can't remember what the specific question was, but I remember Jude Kelly likening anti-racism work to being like being on the STEP program, the recovery program concerning Alcoholics Anonymous.
Yeah.
And at that moment when she was making that comparison, and I'll ask you to talk about it in a minute, Joanne, I saw Joanne nodding with such resonance. And because I know Joanne's journey, I was like, that's got to be Joanne. And we'd been sitting next to each other for half an hour and hadn't realised. But she made such a beautiful and powerful observation about the power of acceptance in this process. And I wondered what it was about that. You're nodding, and so I imagine you remember it too.
I do.
That if you can share a little bit more about what that meant to you and if you can see the link as well.
Yes. Yes. Yeah, I loved that moment in the talk. And I didn't realise that that was when you realised that it was me sitting next to you. The two just fit so nicely in that context, because what they were talking about on stage, like you said, was acceptance. And what I've come to understand about, I think, any addictive behaviour, but we're using in this context alcohol, which is the thing that I'm now abstinent from. You can't embark on the recovery process, certainly the 12-step process, without admitting that there's a problem. And so the very first step is acknowledging that your life has become unmanageable and that you don't have control over the use of alcohol anymore. In the same way that you will never, ever be able to make any changes to your thinking, to your behavior around the way that you interact as a white person in the world, if you aren't first willing to acknowledge that your way of operating might be defective, that it might be informed by the way that, you know, society — you could speak about this way more eloquently than I can — but the way that our systems and society has been set up, we don't consciously, many of us, I don't believe that we choose to operate in this way, but it is just how the world runs. And until we create space to at least examine and go, huh, maybe this isn't actually so good, maybe not everyone benefits from this, there can be no progress. So the link between the two of actually embarking on a journey of change within the context of sobriety and embarking on the journey of recovering and looking at your inherent racism, I think there's a strong correlation. And I thought you might ask me about this today. And I thought, what is it particularly that really kind of strongly links these? And for me, I think it's in the 12-step process, there is a fourth step, which is the inventory step, where you basically — it was a horrendous process, but it's also so liberating — you write down all of the resentments that you have towards people, places, and things in your life. Mine took months. You know, every little thing. And I always like to say with the resentment process, if you imagine that every — between you and every interaction or person, there's like a cord. And if you think about that cord that exists, is it kind of clear and clean, and does it flow freely? And if there's any kind of like icky anger, resentment, misunderstanding, if there's anything that's murky in that cord, then you write that down on your list, and you write down what happened, how it affected you. And the final columns, which are where all the magic happens, is what your part in it was.
Gold.
Oh my gosh. And it's a mind-boggling process, because obviously when you write down all your resentments, there is no part that you had. It was all the other person. And actually what blew my mind about that process and has totally changed the way that I operate in the world is that even the things that I really felt hard done by, like I had an ex-boyfriend who cheated on me for ages. It was awful. He just lied to me over and over again. And I took him back and the whole thing happened again for another year. And even that resentment, which I was like, well, there's nothing that, you know, I was perfect in this. I was so forgiving and he was horrible. But actually, like, when you look at those, the four columns at the end, the columns are, was I selfish? Was I dishonest? Was I self-seeking, frightened? Or was I inconsiderate? And so for that resentment, I'll just give you this as an example, because it was a powerful one for me. My boyfriend cheating on me for the amount of time that he did, I was dishonest with myself because it happened. I didn't trust him and I took him back and I wanted to make the relationship work. So there was a level of dishonesty towards myself and who he had shown himself to be, who I knew he was. Self-seeking, frightened. I didn't want to be on my own. I used him because I wanted to feel safe in that relationship over actually learning to stand on my own two feet and having to heal from that situation. So even in a situation like that, where you just think, oh, you did nothing wrong, you were the victim in that. No, there were parts that I can accept. And that's when the resentment begins to loosen, is when you can start to see, I have some accountability here. And that has been a humbling experience for me, working the 12 steps in that way. And it's also been really helpful on the beginning journey of my anti-racism work, because I hope I have a little bit of humility to be able to accept that I am not perfect.
Yes.
And that there are ways in which I go about the world which are far from ideal. And it doesn't make me a bad person.
Yeah.
And I think that's the thing, is no one wants to be bad. Mm. And so we're so afraid to look at anything,
yeah,
you know, in case of what we might find. But actually, you can be a good person with a good heart and still have some pretty shitty behaviours. Excuse my French.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oh, beautiful. Thank you. And how long have you been sober now, if you don't mind me asking?
Nearly 8 years.
Wow. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And was there a defining moment for you where you were like, this has got to change, or I'm ready? Can you remember if that was the case, mm-hmm. what that was?
Yeah. So the biggest moments were not actually the ones that led me to stop drinking. I had some really traumatic experiences in my teenage years around alcohol and sex. Mm-hmm. Not consensual sex. Mm. That didn't make me question my drinking. It's kind of a reflection sometimes. You kind of put the pieces together and you're like, oh, that wasn't
welcome
great.
To being human.
Yeah. But actually, that wasn't the thing that led me to look at sobriety. But the thing that was kind of the tipping point for me was when I was 24, I had been graduated from drama school for about 3 years. And I had slowly descended into drinking a lot. And not often. It could be maybe once or twice a week, but when I drank, it was really, really like a big blowout. And I would black out. That was something that happened to me really for a lot of my drinking life. I thought everyone did. I just wouldn't remember huge segments of the night. And so that was happening and it was getting increasingly worse. And being a control freak, I really wanted to stop it and find a way of managing it. But every time I picked up the first drink, somehow I'd end up back in a situation where I was completely out of control and had memory loss. And what actually ended up happening, long story short, is I was set up on a blind date with someone who I knew nothing about, and he was in recovery. And I'd actually just come off a 2-day bender. It was really bizarre timing. So I'd had this very dramatic 2 days in which I had hardly slept and told my best friend's boyfriend that I was in love with him. It was like a very crazy 2 days. And then I went straight on to, literally rolled out of bed, straight onto this date with this guy. And we're sitting in the pub and he orders an orange juice. And I'm like, what? You're ordering an orange juice. Do you not drink? And he's like, no, I'm sober. And we ended up, I don't know why he decided to embark on a relationship with me, but we ended up together for 6 months. And I learned so much from him in that 6-month period. It didn't work out as a long-term relationship. But actually, the kind of point for me where I decided I wanted to be sober is we broke up and I hadn't stopped drinking during our relationship, but I was drinking a lot less.
Okay.
And then we broke up. He ended up meeting someone else and off he went. And I reached a fork in the roads where I went, well, I really want to just, you know, press the fuck it button right now. And I want to just go out and get drunk because I'm heartbroken. But I've also learned a huge amount about myself, about what sobriety could look like. And it was at that point, actually, after he left my life, that I decided that I wanted to explore it for myself.
That's the purpose that he served for you.
Totally.
That's the purpose that he served for you.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow. Beautiful. Thank you. So can you tell me a little bit more about Mother Heart and some of the work that you do now as a result of your own journey?
Yeah, sure. So the sobriety stuff, actually, I don't really work professionally around that stuff. And that's mainly because I've got sober through 12-step fellowship and it's free.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just feel actually, you know, unless you're working with a counselor every day, sobriety is a really hard thing to be paying someone to help you with.
Yeah.
So that's just my personal position on it. But I do work as a counsellor and a coach and an EFT practitioner, which kind of ties into that work as well.
And give the definition of EFT for those who don't know the acronym.
So it stands for Emotional Freedom Technique. So it's an easy way to understand it is it's a trauma release mechanism where you can release emotions that are being trapped and held within your body.
Yeah. It's beautiful. If you've never tried it before, it's absolutely, I think it's a very powerful tool.
Me too. So we've had similar-ish trajectories, I feel, in some ways, because we both came from kind of more of a creative background and now are working more in mental well-being and
Yeah, I mean, that industry also needs some anti-racism work, but I think it's full of, you know, I speak for myself. I found it very easy to act. I found it very easy to be somebody else other than myself. Mm-hmm. Perhaps as a form of coping or escaping, I don't know. But it's also an industry that's very much about what you look like, and has a lot of broken people within it. And so, yeah, it kind of didn't surprise me that I ended up moving on from the acting world and going into mental health. And also kind of tying it back together, the public speaking, storytelling, supporting others. I feel what I do now is I'm better able to serve. So I'm grateful for being in that industry, but it was very difficult for me as a Black woman.
Mm-hmm. Mm. And do you think you're not doing it now? Do you think it would be different now with the way that things have unfolded over the last, I don't know, year or so in the industry, year and a half?
No, is the answer. And I say that because I am supporting peers who are working in the industry or who have had to leave the UK to go and find work in America because they couldn't get cast, and are feeling frustrated about the limitations that have been placed on them because of their race and what they look like. And there was a big blowout with Equity in the press recently, and Lawrence Fox, and it was just handled appallingly. So I think, again, unless people are intentionally taking steps to address what their own racism looks like and then in turn how that manifests in industries systemically, then nothing will change. It just takes on different formats.
Yeah, agreed. And I know I saw that Lawrence Fox stuff. It was atrocious. And something else as well that I don't know, you might want to correct me on this, but I feel a little bit like whatever changes are happening in the industry feel quite surface level, that they've been called in, as you like to say, and they're responding, which is good in a way that there are now, there seem to be more dramas that are more inclusive and exploring the lives and experiences of people of colour, perhaps more than there were 5 years ago. But I don't know, I can't help but feel it is all a bit kind of paying lip service.
Yeah.
And
I mean, I guess the beauty of the work that I do is that I encourage the people to be very open and transparent with me. And some of it is lip service. Some of it is tokenism. Because what you then find is you might get more visual representation on a surface level, but behind the scenes, the people who are writing and telling the stories are not Black or brown or are not from different communities. And you just miss the nuances and, you know, sensitivity around how something is produced or put together or directed is missed. And so, there are elements that are being left out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can completely imagine that.
And I think, again, unless people are consciously choosing to undertake this work, it's not sustainable. Mm-hmm. It's not sustainable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. If it's only kind of skin deep, sorry to use that phrase, excuse the pun, but like if it doesn't go any deeper than just a superficial level, then like you said, it's like almost once this phase is through and we're not looking so much at this, it's such a hot topic right now. It's very much the conversation and voices like Layla who've been amazingly catapulted to the fore. But if it's not actually hitting people's hearts, then in a few years, we're not going to be any better off.
Yeah. And you know what's really interesting at the moment? There's been a lot of discussion around Clap for Carers. And I've just done a solo episode. I don't know when that will drop. But it's almost like a split down the middle. There's people that absolutely love it and there's people who hate it. And so I put a call out on my Instagram and I said, look, I feel conflicted by it. I'd love to hear your own thoughts. And so for those who really struggle with it, I'm hearing the same reasoning coming back over and over again. It's like, we've been doing this work. We've been underappreciated. People are not campaigning for better pay. People are being called immigrants, being told that they're a drain on their society, being told to go back to their own country. And yet the most people who are on the front line at the moment are those very same people that we want to boot out of our country. Calls from the government to ask nurses to come back from retirement. A huge demographic are from the Windrush generation, from Caribbean people. And a great article I read said, you know what, I'm not answering the call from the government to go back in service. And it's not because I don't want to go back and be a nurse. It's because I don't want to go back and experience the racism. Mm. And so I think there's this feeling that, you know, for those who are struggling with clap for carers, it just feels meaningless. Well, we can clap and we can cheer, but afterwards, what will change?
Yeah, it's just again, empty.
Unless we actively take steps, whether that's holding our government accountable, whether that is fundraising, whether that is donating, whether that is doing your own anti-racism work so that you start to see people as human beings rather than immigrants, nothing will change. And so for me, the clapping is a bit of it's a metaphor for that for me.
Mm-hmm. Understood.
It's meaningless. It's, you know, beyond we can show gratitude, of course, but we have to do more than just be a good person.
Yeah. And your post recently about that, bringing attention to the fact that the mainstream media was really sharing a lot of images of white nurses.
Yeah.
And I saw that post. And I saw a comment that you had replied to on your post saying, because someone has said, and you said, did you notice that it was only white faces? And my answer is, I didn't even notice until reading your post and looking at your exchange with whoever that person was. And I thought, I didn't even notice. Yeah. I just saw white faces and I was like, oh, yeah. Like, it just didn't even land with me. But of course, the NHS is made up of people of all colours and predominantly people who are of colour.
Yeah.
And even after doing this work, I still didn't notice.
Yeah. And I think that to me is a beautiful and honest, you know, because there are some people who want to do this work and tick the box that they've done it and then that's it. No, it's not it. Part of being anti-racist is noticing our absence.
Yeah.
And that's in your mind now. You will notice from now on.
Mm-hmm. I hope so, Nova. And also, just to go into that a little bit more, because I had a conversation with my husband about it. Is it that, like, at what level does that happen, do you think? Is it that the photographer groups together a selection of people that they know are going to fit what needs to be printed in the paper? Is it that lots of photos are taken and the editorial team go, oh, we'll use this one with seven white people in it? Like, where is it even happening that these choices get made?
It's probably happening at all levels. And for many, for some, it is conscious, no doubt about it. They want to project a certain narrative and they will do what they need to do. Yeah, it is calculated, it is conscious. For others, it is subconscious. And so a lot about not just anti-racism, but, you know, thinking more about diversity and inclusion. So getting more representation across the board of, you know, people who serve in the NHS who have a disability, people who serve in the NHS who are queer or in the LGBTQ community.
Yeah.
In order to improve that visual representation, you have to do that consciously. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you might just want to take pictures of who's there, but actually, I believe if they're taking these pictures in a London hospital and they're showing only white faces, then that's been conscious, because I think over 44% of NHS workers are in the BAME community. So it wasn't representative.
No.
It wasn't representative. So I think it is a mixture, but generally, if you are wanting to improve inclusion, you have to consciously do that. If you have not unlearned your racism, you have to consciously do that. Otherwise, you won't be looking for it and you'll just take a picture of whoever's there.
Yeah.
Rather than let's get a bit more representation here.
Yep. Makes total sense.
Yeah. And that's across the board.
Yeah. Just to go back to 12-step briefly, I'm linking it again with what we're talking about now. So there is a noticeable absence of people of colour in those rooms. I don't know if that's a conversation you've had with people,
no, but
I've got a couple of my sober friends who are women of colour, don't feel safe in those rooms. And I think a big part of that is when you're working your step four, when you're going through these resentments with a safe person, you need to feel seen and heard about the hurts that you've encountered in your life. And if it's a black person with a white person who might discredit or undermine that experience. Yeah. So I understand why, but I think it's also, I know it's a huge shame because there is so much promise and there is people of all colours have drink problems.
Yeah.
And this is a free resource. And how can we fix that? How can we make that accessible to everyone as it's supposed to be?
Well, I think first of all, recognising it is an important component, and then going, you know, if you are connected with those service providers, then going back to them and saying, I have noticed this as an ally, what can we start to do to make safe spaces? And then if it's engaging in training, if it's engaging in consultancy, if it's engaging with focus groups to help understand what will make those spaces safe, because when I use the word safe space, it's not a space where you're never going to experience any kind of conflict or difficulty, but it's a space where exactly what you said, you can be seen, heard and understood without being undermined. And I think what you're highlighting is an issue in healthcare across the board, in psychiatry, in counselling services. So many black women and brown women, people of colour, mostly women, will come to me and say, I really need support for my mental health. I've just started counselling. A lot of what is contributing to mental ill health for these people are their experiences of racism. You go into a door with a therapist and they're white and you're trying to start to explain the magnitude of what microaggressions are to somebody who doesn't even know what the word means. You don't feel safe, you feel invalidated, and it's highly unlikely you're going to go back. It's highly unlikely. So I think it's vital that this is in the conscious minds of people who are in caregiving roles. Yeah,
agreed.
And if we need to be creating, you know, services that are specifically for that niche whilst we're trying to figure out how to make the mainstream version more inclusive, then I think that's vital. But what you've highlighted is a problem across the board.
You're right, it goes beyond 12-step. And that is it, is how can any therapist or psychotherapist hold space for an individual when they don't understand or respect that person's painful experience? Like it's an impossibility if they don't have that awareness, that level of anti-racism work.
I mean, I went to a event just towards the end of last year, and it was about mental health. It was about the impact of microaggressions on mental health of people of colour, particularly black people. The data was more leaning towards evidence around the implications towards black people, black women in particular. And there were psychiatrists there, other caregivers, psychologists, and it was a very important conversation, but it was reinforcing what we already knew in the room. And a lot of psychiatry is not inclusive and is based on medical racism. And it's shown the disproportionate amount of people who are black who are automatically sectioned under the Mental Health Care Act, who are not giving the same ongoing support afterwards to help manage with their mental ill health, are over-medicated. And where even in the initial diagnosis stage, there is nothing during these forms. Like when I was working in mental health, we would have to get clients who we were risk assessing. It was a form which they needed to complete to ascertain where they needed to go within the service. And it would ask you things about what, you know, how are you feeling? What do you think has contributed to this? And there's not even a question on there that puts racism down as a real form of contributing factor. Racism is a form of trauma and it's not even listed.
Wow.
So, I mean, that's a bigger conversation and that's something for membership bodies like the BACP and, you know, alternative governing membership bodies to get on board with. It's urgent.
Yeah, completely.
Thank you for asking that question or just, you know, expressing that, because I think it's important.
Yeah, no, you're so right. It reaches far beyond individual. It's all caring professions, isn't it? When it's linked to mental well-being, everyone needs to be equipped and to be trained in this.
Yeah, yeah.
And we're not.
We're very, the majority are not.
Yeah.
But actually when you are, it is the most healing thing you can do for a Black person, a Black woman who has been taught to suppress and hold on to their emotions and internalize them. One of the most powerful things you can do as a caregiver is listen and hold space, because it's so often not done. So often battered away, defended, minimized, explained away.
One of the most helpful things that I took away from the day that we did with you, and it's so obvious, but oh my gosh, I don't think any of us know it, is when we cause harm rather than defend and refute and deny and close down, shut down the person, is to actually ask why it was harmful. What is it that I said or did that has hurt your feelings, and how can I do better? You know, tell me how I can improve. What would be helpful? That words to that effect, you probably will say a lot better than I did. But I thought, oh my God, we don't do that.
And the main thing, well, there's a step before that.
Yeah.
Apologising,
thank you.
The step before that is apologising. And again, when you strip it back, it is so simple. But what happens if we go in this shame spiral where we make it about ourselves and the fact that, no, I don't want to be bad, or we then focus on our intentions and what we did or didn't mean. And meanwhile, that person's been hurt.
Yeah.
And when we bring it back to this, racism is trauma, and I have unknowingly caused pain to another human being, all I need to do in that moment as a bare minimum is apologize.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's scary how infrequently that happens. And I know from my own life when I've been called out on things.
Yeah.
And my, you know, the default setting is to defend and to show the other person that they've misunderstood or it wasn't what I intended to say. It's just like, what is wrong with us? Can we, like, really? It's so obvious and it's so simple.
Mm.
That was a big learning point for me. I've shared that with lots of people.
Thank you. I'm glad. It's an important one. So simple that we can all do from today.
Yeah.
Even if we don't know, understand why immediately.
Yeah.
That might come later. The most important is to honour and apologise. So, two more questions. What would you say to anyone who is lurking? No, actually, what would you say to anyone who, like you, was at a point where they thought, well, I don't need to do this work. I don't need to do anti-racism work. What would you say to someone like that, or to somebody who's like, okay, perhaps I need to, but I feel really embarrassed about what might come up?
I would say, for people who don't believe that they need to do it, the most powerful thing I heard was when Layla said that as a Black woman, she is having to unpick her own racist behavior, beliefs, thoughts. So if a person of color is having to unpick it, I would find it a miracle if a white person doesn't have that work to do as well in their own lives. That really helped me. And again, it's the it's like the release of shame is just going like, this doesn't make you a bad person. And her saying that gave me permission to be like, okay, maybe there is a few things that I could sort through and improve on here, you know. And that was just to get me over the edge and to get me engaged, and it really worked. So I think that's the first thing. If people of color are having to unpack and unpick in this way, then it is a requirement that we do the same.
Beautiful. Thank you.
That would be the first thing.
Is there another thing?
What was the second question?
It kind of was one. I say I've got one question and then I throw in like five.
I can't remember what the second one was, but something about someone who's afraid of what they might find.
Yeah.
Oh, gosh. I mean, there are feelings that are going to come up. The thing is this is not pretty work. You know, for you as a person of colour, being on the receiving end of it, there are feelings that you have had to endure and experience at the hands of white people. And so we're not going to get off scot-free in terms of if we're wanting to repair and do our part, then it is going to be challenging, and it is going to require you to look inside and to see, like I said, the ugly bits, you know. But ultimately, I'm sure there's so many amazing self-help quotes about this, but this idea of like cleaning house is like, you know, if you want a clean house, you first got to see the dirt. Yeah. You have to be willing to have a look at what's under the rug.
Yeah.
First.
Yeah. Perfect. And so how do you find calm in chaos?
How do I find calm in chaos? Social media management.
Go on.
Like being careful about my use of social media. I find that can really take away my peace of mind. We've discussed this recently with what's going on with the pandemic. Yeah. News, like managing how often I'm engaging with it. I don't want to be in denial about what's going on, of course, but once a day at the moment, if I watch the 10 o'clock news in the evening and I'm like, okay, I feel like I know what's going on, I don't need to be poring over the papers throughout the day as well and refreshing my news app. It's just too much. Naps.
You're a napper.
I'm a napper. Naps, actually, I had one before we started recording this. It was only like 20 minutes, but it just slows my breathing down. And I find naps quite helpful. What else do I do for calm? I guess a big thing that I have always struggled with is like moving into the victim mentality and feeling resentful about things in life. Like, oh, this person's not replied to my message, or, you know, feeling hard done by. It's so ridiculous, but I can really get myself into a pickle with just feeling hard done by. And so I think something that really brings me calm is actually trying to step outside of myself. Again, it kind of goes back to step four, step work is looking at my part in it. What am I trying to get from this person? Where am I being selfish? How can I stand in their position? What might be going on for them right now? You know, and what might explain why they've read a message and haven't replied to it, or whatever. And just because I find those things can interrupt my peace of mind is feeling resentful. And so actually just, taking myself out of myself and looking at the bigger picture is helpful for me.
Can help. And it also reminds me of, because I do that as well. Someone doesn't reply or whatever it may be. And then I've gone into a spiral and we're having this full dramatic play of what could be going on that may or may not be true. And so what I do is I ask myself, Nova, what do you need in this moment? What do I need? And sometimes that's something more basic, like fresh air, a walk, to listen to music, to change my energy. I need to feel secure. Then not responding is making me feel insecure. So what makes me feel secure? And then I'm able to move on.
That's really nice. Because it is rarely about the thing, right? We think it's about the person not replying, but it is usually something else.
Always.
That's super
sometimes,
helpful.
Sometimes people might be rude, but generally it's normally about us in some way.
Yeah.
So last question. I did say that was the last question, but no, I want to ask you
Keep
this.
Going.
What piece of music brings you huge joy?
Oh my gosh.
I know.
What one piece?
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to go for, I've just discovered a new musician called, let me get his name right, Benjamin Leftwich Francis. No, Benjamin Francis Leftwich. And he's wonderful. And there's a song called Pictures that I love. And there's also a song called Kicking Roses. And he's a very talented lyricist and he plays the guitar and I think he's wonderful. And I listen to him a lot at the moment. Yeah.
Oh, Joanne, I could talk to you for hours. I've absolutely loved speaking with you today. Thank you so much for joining me. Thank you for being open, being honest, being vulnerable and being on this journey to being anti-racist. It's a pleasure to have you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
Before I let you go, can you let my listeners know where they can find you and if you've got anything coming up that might be useful for them?
How quickly is this going out?
Oh, that depends. I don't know is the answer. Okay. I've got about at least four ahead of you.
So depending on how long this pandemic lasts, I'm currently doing, as you know, daily anxiety management, sort of drop-in sessions, 45 minutes in the morning. By the time this goes out, I'm hoping that we will no longer be in lockdown. But that's a way that I'm sort of working with groups of people at the moment, and it seems to be being really well received, which is wonderful.
Lovely. But
more generally, my Instagram, which is where I post about anti-racism work and sobriety and faith and mental well-being, is at Motherheart.
And beyond that, what sort of things, when we're back in real life contact, what sort of things do you offer in person?
Yeah, so I do, from a work perspective, I do group and one-to-one sessions. So I've been running lots of kind of meditation and sound healing sessions, different venues, and I work usually in Old Street in London, and I've got like a one-to-one space there where I'll see people privately as well.
Lovely. Do you work virtually?
I do actually. And at the moment I'm only obviously doing that. Yeah, it's been quite a shift. I've always, for some reason, have been really into like old school, like, no, I need to be in the room with people.
Yeah.
And suddenly that's all had to change. And actually I'm quite enjoying being virtual. It's not as bad as I thought. But I think when things go back to normal, I probably will go back to in-person events as much as possible. Yeah.
Perfect.
Yeah.
Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
Well, did I tell you, so much good stuff in that episode. And if you are white or you hold white privilege, I hope you got some gold from that. Just seeing some of the to-ing and fro-ing that Joanne and I were doing to encourage her to self-interrogate around her thoughts and behaviour and whether they are or aren't racist or not. And just exploring what racism might look like when it's so, so subtle, because that is all of the work that I'm talking about, where we can really make a difference and start to recognise it in ourselves and each other. And if you have listened to previous episodes, the one with Selena Barker, who has also gone on an anti-racism journey, it's really interesting just to observe what this can look like depending on where you are. It's really, really interesting, and I hope you're able to learn something from our conversation. And I personally loved what Joanne has just spoke about, I believe, so openly, and it just made so much sense to me about the link between her understanding and her experience on the 12-step program and the link between acceptance and accountability within that program and the same need for those ingredients in becoming anti-racist and what that can feel like, just acknowledging that actually I was in this kind of victim mode, and actually I realized I'm one of the oppressors and this does not feel good to me and I want to reject this with all my might, but actually it's not about me and my feelings, it's about actually helping and being part of the solution. When you get to that point, which I'm sure many of you are closer to that than others, the work just feels very, very different, and yeah, it becomes you. So thank you. I just want to update on some stats. I have stats floating around in my head all of the time, and I just want to make sure that I'm giving you accurate information. And I gave you a stat of the number of BAME workers, so Black, Asian, Minority, Ethnic NHS workers in London, being 44%. It's actually higher than that. It's 52%. NHS workers who are BAME in London hospitals. Nationally, the representation of BAME NHS workers is 20%. So I just want to give you a little bit of data there. So all that's to say is, if you are interested in joining my online anti-racism course, which is not the one that Jo's done an in-person masterclass, and I hope when all of this ends, I'll be repeating those in autumn. Head on over to my website, novareed.com, for more information about how this stuff works when you lean in and when you get past that acceptance and accountability stage. And if you want to find out more about Joanne's work, then please go over and follow Mother Heart. And thank you for tuning in. You know what to do. If this episode has resonated with you, please leave me a review. You can find me over at Nova Reed Official. Can't wait to tune in with you again soon. Take care of you.